here on BCFM.
BCFM.
A mystery always holds sway over those who don't understand it. And the priesthood was born. No king ever existed without the permission of the priesthood. And I don't care what religion you're talking about or what period of history you're talking about, it is the truth. The kings never had the power and don't to this day. Kings exist at the whim of the real power, which is the priesthood standing behind the throne. And when the king ceased to be a benefit to the priesthood, they would simply poison him or get rid of him in some other way.
Back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. As a shifty-looking Alexander Petrov and Ruslan Bushirov appear on Russia Today, they are their real names after all. Boris Johnson and Theresa May call them murderers, but where is the evidence, the perfume bottle, and the explanation why the so-called Novichok didn't kill the targets? They presumably have evidence on these Russian bunglers. Why aren't they sharing it with us? Could it be these apparent nerve agent attacks in Salisbury and Amesbury originate in Porton Down, chemical weapons labs, just a few miles away, right in between the two towns, Amesbury and Salisbury? Is there any link to MI6 and the CIA's battle with Moscow for Idlib and for Syria, 2,500 miles away from Salisbury? Meanwhile, more Russian nerve agents are discovered in Holland with help from the Swiss, who discovered them trying to hack into the Swiss government's chemical weapons lab. This all happened back in March, but we've only just been told. Also, expert nuclear scientist Chris Busby, who's been taking the MOD on and winning in the courts, he comes home to Biddeford in Cornwall earlier this week to find a wide police cordon around his home. They say his lab is a bomb factory. Exclusive interview with Chris plus Fukushima and the Skripals in a minute. And I'm off to Arnhem next week to look at the origins of the Bilderberg conferences for the 74th commemoration of the famous World War II battle portrayed in the film A Bridge Too Far. And a bit of help from Manfred Petrich later, he'll be here to explain the Nazi links between organised crime and Battle of Arnhem back then. Plus, Martin Summers takes us to some of the world hotspots the mass media turn a blind eye to. Our sister show Dialects Online, now at dialectradio.co.uk. This week, a regular Bristol visitor to Lebanon, Di Karawacki, recounts her experience of how Israeli invasions of Lebanon and ISIS jihadis next door in Syria impacted on Beirut and Lebanese life. We also hear from freelance technology journalist Chris Hewitt on promises back in 1975 from Shirley Williams and Roy Jenkins that joining the EEC, as it then was, would never lead to political or monetary union. Listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download it from dialectradio.co.uk now. And for Tuesday week's programme, we've got a real special, which is Joe House from the Climate Change Science Department at Bristol University, discussing, is climate change really man-made, with the Leader of the Opposition's brother, Piers Corbyn. An hour of really interesting, actually fascinating scientific discussion about climate change. That's Tuesday week at noon on Dialect. But we start, Martin, with this interview, extraordinary interview, aired on RT, and excerpts of which have been put on to the BBC, etc., with these two fascinating characters from Russia, Petrov and Bosirov.
Yeah, obviously we constantly, this is a soap opera that continues to develop. I think the most significant fact, though, is that they arrived in Salisbury 2 hours too late to have painted anything on the door handle. That's what it looks like at the minute. So the story about Novichok on the door handle has to go, or they have to go as the suspects because they arrived too late. And you could say, well, perhaps they did it the day before, but if they did it the day before, why did they come back the second day? Don't forget the Skripals left home, from what we know, at 9 a.m. and didn't come back. They may have come back, but the British police have to show us that they did come back, and then it becomes possible for them to have painted the door and for the Skripals to have touched it. Although, of course, they should have died immediately if it was Novichok. And that's another thing that hasn't really been explained
before
to us.
Why
only one person's died, although four people were supposedly in contact with the stuff.
Okay, so before we go any further into discussing evidence, let's hear from Petrov and Bosharov themselves. And this was this is about 4 minutes long altogether, but it's a bit more than we've been hearing on the news. We just keep hearing a few little excerpts. And so here's a bit more than the news people have been giving us here in London.
No, initially we planned to go to London and have some fun there. This time it wasn't a business trip. Our plan was to spend some time in London and then to visit Salisbury. Of course, we wanted to do it all in one day. But when we got there, our plane couldn't land on its first approach. That's because of all the havoc they had with transport in the UK on March the 2nd and 3rd. There was a heavy snowfall. Nearly all cities in the UK were paralyzed, and we weren't able to go anywhere.
Railroads didn't work on March the 2nd and March the 3rd. Motorways were also closed. Police cars and ambulances blocked off highways. There was no traffic at all. No trains, nothing. Why is that no transport was operating? Why is that nobody talks about any of this?
Can you give us a timeline, minute by minute, or at least hour by hour, or as much as you can remember? You arrived in the UK, like you said, to have some fun, to see the cathedral, to see some clock in Salisbury. Can you tell us what you did in the UK? You spent 2 days there, right?
Actually, three.
So what did you do for those 3 days?
We arrived on March 2nd. We went to the train station to check the schedule, to see where we could go.
The initial plan was to go there for a day, just to take a look and return the same day.
To Salisbury, that is. One day Salisbury is enough.
No,
we arrived in Salisbury on March the 3rd. We wanted to walk around the city. We tried to have a walk, but since the whole city was covered with snow, we only spent half an hour there. We were all wet.
There are no pictures, the media, television. Nobody talks about the fact that the transport system was paralyzed that day. It was impossible to get anywhere because of the snow. We were drenched up to our knees.
We naturally were going there to see the Stonehenge, Old Sarum and the cathedral, but it didn't work out. The whole city was covered with slush. We got wet, so we went back to the train station and took the first train to go back. We spent about 40 minutes at the train station, at a coffee shop.
We were drinking coffee, a hot drink, because we were drenched.
On March 4th, we went back there because the snow melted in London and it was warm.
It was sunny.
And we thought we really wanted to see Old Sarum and the cathedral. So we decided to give it another try on March 4th.
Well, don't you think that it's kind of stupid for two straight men to be carrying perfume for ladies? Why would a man have women's perfume in his bag?
Even an ordinary person would have such questions. Why would a man need perfume for women?
Long story short, did you have that Nina Ricci bottle or not?
No.
No, of course not.
Speaking of you being straight men, all the footage features you two together. You spent time together, you stayed together, you went for a walk together. What do you have in common that you spent so much time together?
You know, let's not breach anyone's privacy here. We came to you seeking protection. But this is turned into some kind of an interrogation. You're going too far.
So that's what they said, Martin, that they were going too far by prying too much into, you know, whether their what exactly their relationship between the two men was. They certainly looked quite well built, didn't they? Possibly military, but then some would say a lot of Russians are stocky.
Well, I mean, their official business, they claim, is basically helping bodybuilders by providing them with supplements. And what I felt about them is they are possibly involved in illegal supplies of steroids to bodybuilders, which is why they're a bit pretty cagey about what they actually do. Because what they actually do for business is possibly quite dodgy, which is why they're being a bit cagey about it. It could be that they are GRU agents. It's possible. And of course, the Skripals switched off their mobile phones when they left the house at 9 a.m. that day, which is very strange. People don't do that, really. I suppose they might if they don't want anybody to contact them. But it's possible that these are GRU agents who are trying to contact the Skripals as part of some undercover mission.
Well, we did hear right at the very start of all this back in March in the Independent from one of Sergei Skripal's friends. He actually contacted the Independent and said, well, I've been no Sergei, and he has been expressing a wish for some time to actually return to Russia. Now, this is very difficult for someone who's a former double agent. They're not just going to welcome him back at the airport, and he was trying to negotiate his return.
All right, well, this is all speculative, but let's say that these guys are GRU, and they come to Salisbury to find the Skripals. That's not necessarily the case. They may be, as they say, that what they need to be is interrogated. But it could be that the whole Novichok thing has been set up to set the Russians up. And, you know, the fact that the police officer has disappeared, that Skripal's disappeared, that Yulia's disappeared, and then when the story's dying, suddenly the perfume bottle appears and two people get died. But only one person has died. If it's Novichok, which they claim it is, then everybody should be dead straight away. If they came and painted the door. Now, what they're saying is it didn't work because they painted the door on.
Well, we talk because we sometimes skip over Dawn Sturgis and Charlie Rowley, that whole incident, and it's well documented now that they were actually on hard drugs, so their health wasn't particularly good anyway. No. All it would take would be a batch of bad drugs for one of them to cop it, really.
Interestingly enough, there was a statement by somebody from Salisbury Hospital saying that there were several people treated not for nerve agents. None of them were treated for nerve agents. That's what the guy said, and there was no danger to the public. And in actual fact, the Skripals were treated as if they were fentanyl victims to begin with. Fentanyl is a very, very strong form of heroin, which has been going around in Wiltshire and elsewhere in the world, 100 times stronger than normal street heroin. And that the symptoms that they showed, although we've never seen any CCTV footage of the symptoms or anything, and it's not been explained to us how the police officer, and of course he's a detective sergeant, he's not a beat officer, he was also supposedly brought down by Novichok. Did he go to the house? Did he touch the door handle? Did he all of this has not been explained. Now, leaving aside whether they're GRU or not GRU, this whole question of Novichok. I mean, most people have failed to recognise that the Russians, under supervision, when Craig Murray was the ambassador in Uzbekistan, dismantled their equivalent of Porton Down completely, and people came in and took everything away. We were supposed to dismantle Porton Down as a quid pro quo, but far from dismantling Porton Down, on the back of what's happened, they're going to get a massive investment of public money so they can carry on doing what they do in there. Now, don't forget that this whole idea of chemical weapons is very much a Western trope. The chemical weapons like the phosphorus that was used to attack Gaza or Fallujah, they are supposedly banned, but the Americans use them and they use white phosphorus. The point is they're not that much more dangerous than anything else. It's a whole thing of they've got to think of something that the Russians are doing which is illegal, where they can say
well,
international law doesn't matter.
There seems
matter.
To be a very stupendous lack of evidence, but there is evidence emerging all the time. One of which is that the just yesterday, the Skripal suspects, tourists claims apparently are offensive to victims, the government says. And also the website Bellingcat has been doing a joint investigation with the Russian Insider, which has confirmed through uncovered passport data the two Russian nationals identified by UK authorities as prime suspect in the Novichok poisonings in Salisbury are linked to the Russian security services. What they say, Bellingcat says, has just published this, the Insider and Bellingcat confirm that two men were registered in the Central Russian Resident Database under the names Alexander Yevgenovich Petrov and Ruslan Timovarich Bosirov, respectively, and were issued internal passports under these names in 2009. However, no records exist for these two persons prior to that date, suggesting the two names were likely cover identities for operatives of one of the Russian security services. Crucially, at least one man's passport contains various top-secret markings, in inverted commas, which, according to two sources consulted by Bellingcat, are typically reserved for members of secret services or top state operatives, but they won't show pictures of what those markings are or explain or confirm what those markings are at all on Bellingcat.
Bellingcat basically is a front organisation for MI6. It was set up supposedly by somebody who'd been made redundant from IT, and then they became an expert on all the kind of weaponry that was being used in Syria, and they've been pushed by the West as an independent non-governmental voice and all the rest of it. But in actual fact, they just echo MI6 propaganda, and the general view of them is that it may well be that these guys are GRU, but Bellingcat is definitely MI6. So there you go. I mean, you pays your money, you takes your choice, you know. Who's lying here?
What about this more recent case as well, though, that we've got this so-called Switzerland connection, that Russian spies targeted the Swiss chemical weapons lab, the BBC reported 4 hours ago. And that story reads, the two Russian men were arrested earlier this year on suspicion of spying on a Swiss laboratory investigating the poisoning of Sergei Skripal. A newspaper investigation, Swiss publication Tages Anzeiger and Dutch paper NRC said they were arrested in the Netherlands earlier this year. The Swiss lab analysed samples from the poisoning of the former Russian double agents in the UK. Now, they were expelled from the Netherlands shortly after the arrest, which had not been reported up until now. Swiss intelligence told the BBC the agency had been actively involved in the case of the Russian agent without mentioning the laboratory of Spies, which is near Bern. The Swiss intelligence agency had confirmed the findings of its joint investigation with the Dutch newspaper.
Well, first thing I'd say about that is when they're arrested and expelled, that means there's been no court case here. Yeah? So there's been no court case, so nothing's proven, it's just asserted. Also, I understand that the Swiss laboratory, which may be the one they're talking about, analysed some of the whatever it was that was used, and they came out and said it was some other kind of nerve agent, not Novichok at all, okay? And I think that's checkable.
I think you're talking about BZ, aren't
yeah.
you? The one which is basically a kind of hallucinogenic drug which sends you into a frenzy but doesn't kill you.
Yes, and that sounds much more likely that's what we're talking about here than Novichok. Are you following me? And, of course, that means that what we're talking about here, therefore, is possibly a provocation by MI6. And I would say that the Russians have been saying all this week that MI6 are operating inside Idlib with the white helmets, and they've given lots of information and detail about a chemical weapons attack which is going to take place, which will be then blamed on the Syrian government. Now, you've got to remember that this, as I said to you earlier, this whole thing about chemical weapons, weapons of mass destruction, is a trope of Western intelligence services. Basically, the Russians got rid of all their stuff years ago because they got no use for it.
Okay, so one person that doesn't agree with you is Theresa May's Security Minister Ben Wallace, and here he is last night on Channel 4 News talking about this really, well, I suppose it is what they seem to keep describing as a malign behaviour of Russia.
The EU has sanctioned 150 Russians going right back to Crimea who are still under sanction. And those 150 are the leadership of the Russian armed forces. They are some very senior people in the Russian government. And I'm confident by the response we received from our allies in March when collectively the international community expelled 150 intelligence officers from around the world at an unprecedented scale, that their determination to push back malign Russian behaviour is as strong today as it was back in March.
So you're hoping for more from the EU summit next week?
Well, I'm hoping that eventually Russia will wake up to the existing sanctions that are in place, very significant sanctions going back from the Crimean and the MH17 shooting down of a jet. There is a clear path out of it for Russia, and one of those paths would, of course, be, you know, helping us deal with the two people we suspect of this attempted murder.
So, sorry, just to clarify, you're saying that you're hoping Russia will wake up to the existing sanctions. Is that because you don't think you'll get any more sanctions through the EU?
There is significant sanctions already in place, is my point. 150 people, all at the heart of the Russian state. And, you know, therefore, you can't sanction someone twice. You know, I'm not going to sanction the Russian chief of the general staff twice.
But is there any sign that they're working?
At the moment, you know, I'm not in charge of the sanction assessment. What I would certainly say is at the moment, you know, the Russian economy is not looking good. It is not in a good state. Remember, it is half the size of the British economy. And eventually, you know, the people of Russia, who I notice have decided that President Putin's pension reforms are not as popular as he hopes, will start to realise and make that connection that, you know, the economy is partly affected by these international sanctions driven out of the Russian government's behaviour.
Well, I mean, basically what he's saying there is we're going to make ordinary Russians suffer, you know, through pension cuts and so on, so that they will overthrow the government.
He's talking about wealthy Russians, isn't he? People who do make money out of international trading, that sort of thing.
Well, no, the pension reform is actually the pensions of the ordinary folk, yeah? And then Putin obviously has had some problems with that because he's trying to...
It's Putin that's doing that. It's not Ben Wallace.
No, I know, but the point is that what Ben Wallace is saying is that the sanctions on Russia have led to a situation where they've had to cut pensions for the ordinary folk, and the ordinary folk should then draw the conclusion that it's Putin's nasty behaviour that's led to their pension cut. Now, of course, in other words, they're using sanctions against the ordinary people in order to try and get the leadership isolated. Now, when he mentions MH17, and when most people are not aware of this, but there's been a court case in Kiev, Tony, in which the Berkut riot police were accused of massacring the protesters in the Maidan Square, 80 protesters and several police officers, all shot by expert snipers with the same weapons, and all shot through the head. And there's been a court case in Kiev, and the Berkut riot police were acquitted because two snipers from Georgia testified on a Skype link that they were the people who carried out the assassination, that there were 50 of them, they were all mercenaries from Georgia associated with Shakashvili, who's a big protege of the West, and that the actual operation was run by a US colonel who they named. Now, that's all been in court in Kiev, but it's not been reported on the BBC, has it? Because it completely undermines the whole story about what happened in Kiev 4 years ago.
Just an aside,
the people who were killed by NATO intelligence services, and a US colonel ought to be standing trial and going to prison forever.
Just as an aside to what Ben Wallace had to say there, one of the things he just kind of dropped into the conversation was that the Russian economy is half the size of the UK economy. Why is that? I mean, obviously the Russians are more populated than Britain.
Yeah, but I mean, there's always been a problem for Russia of not being in the core of the world economy. They've been trying to catch up for years. In actual fact, the economy in Russia is actually, the sanctions actually have backfired massively because the Russians basically have gone for a self-sufficiency strategy.
Well, that's right. I was reading
That's what you do when
you're sanctioned. I was reading recently that actually the fact that their economy is small but their industrial output is large is actually a very good thing because it means that people are paying less for things, basic things like bread, water, transport. It all costs far less in Russia.
Yeah, well, Putin has been a success in terms of improving the basically miserable conditions that I used to find when I used to go to Russia in the 1990s, because they've stopped doing the stupid stuff. They've still got a nationalised oil industry. They've still got nationalised banks. They've still got a nationalised rail industry. And this is all a centre-right government in Russia, but they don't believe in privatising everything because they've seen what happens when they did. And that's why Putin is popular, because he's improved the living standards of the ordinary people and made them feel as if the government cares about them for the first time.
So it's got
when Yeltsin was running the show, and of course Yeltsin only scraped home by 50.1%.
Let's try and do this little thing. It's a bit of a game, I suppose, yeah. Really. But comparing Britain and Russia and the economy and the country. Now, Russia in landmass is 70 times the size of Britain. It's much, much bigger. But its economy, its population is only about two or three times the size of Britain. It's 145 million, and Britain's is about 65, 70 million. So you're talking about roughly half the size in population, but 70 times greater in terms of size. So this whole idea of having a self-sufficient economy sounds like quite a good idea to me. Is it something that the Brits should think of, do you think, where there's not so much money every year spent on your basic essentials, things like transport, things like water, things like food, things like rent, and how much you're paying, for example, in a mortgage, etc.?
Well, look, you've got to recognise that economies are path dependent. We're not going to have a coal industry in this country ever again. It's gone. We're never going back to having a coal industry. They've still got a coal industry in Russia, particularly in the Donbass, which is one of the ways that they used to earn foreign exchange. What they've done is they've used their nationalised oil industry to generate profits, which they've then invested in trying to modernise their economy. Don't forget, their economy was very unmodernised back in the day. They've had to gradually, they've gradually turned it around. They've got a basically capitalist economy, but they don't believe in a super free market. And they've balanced what they're trying to do. And of course, they've got masses of resources there, which is what this is really all about.
Now, surely not going to deny this malign Russian behaviour that Ben Wallace was talking about, the Britain security minister there, pointing out, making a particular point of looking at what happened in Crimea in March 2014, and also the downing of MH17 in July 2014. Now, this is only 4 years ago.
Yes, and I just mentioned this earlier. There's been a court case in Kiev, which
We're talking about you're talking about the Maidan protests. I'm talking about Crimea and the MH17.
Yes, the Maidan.
He didn't mention that.
No, the Maidan protests led to the breakaway of Crimea, just like Kosovo broke away from Serbia when we bombed Serbia for 73 days. Do you remember? We bombed the television station and killed their women. Weather girls. Do you remember that? Because Kosovo wanted to be independent
Russia,
of Serbia.
At which point Russia annexed Crimea.
No, they didn't annex it. The people of Crimea voted for independence from Ukraine, and the Russians accepted that, just as the people of Kosovo wanted independence from Serbia. But they still haven't been recognised by lots of countries, including Spain, for example, because breakaways aren't ever recognised unless there's some particular reason. The people in Crimea are overwhelmingly Russian-speaking. They know that the Maidan Square massacre was carried out by the West, because they read it in their newspapers. We don't. And of course, it was even on the day, Umas Piets, who was the Estonian foreign minister, phoned Catherine Ashton, the British foreign spokesperson for the EU, and said, well, we've just been around the hospitals, and what we're being told is that the snipers that killed all these people were working for the new regime, not the old regime. And Agence France-Presse approached Umas Piets, and he confirmed the phone call.
So the evidence
for the beginning of the crisis is that NATO intelligence services killed 80 people and several police officers, and it wasn't the Russians, it was our people who should be standing trial.
What about MH17 in July 2014?
Well, that was
pretty obviously shot down by the Russians.
No, it was not, because in actual fact, they claimed it was shot down by a Buk missile. Now, in actual fact, if there was a Buk missile, there would be massive screenshots from all over the place of the missile being fired, and there aren't any. And you know what? The only people who had Buk missiles in the theatre were the Ukrainians. They had seven Buk missiles in the theatre. If it was going to be shot down by the Russians would have to bring the Buk missile over the border, shoot the plane down, and then move it back over the border into Russia without being detected. And also, of course, there would have been if you fire one of these missiles, there's a huge column of smoke.
You know what this reminds me of is a little bit like Gaddafi, isn't it? Now, Putin is we're being told the malign influence of Russia, malign Russian behaviour. They were saying exactly the same about Gaddafi, and he was the specific things we were being told about him was that he was behind the Lockerbie bombing, and he was behind the murder of PC Yvonne Fletcher. Now, the Dispatches documentary Death in a Murder in St. James absolutely conclusively proved that there was either MI6 or CIA behind the murder of PC Yvonne Fletcher, because of the ballistics and the trajectory of where the bullet came from. Could not have come from the Libyan embassy. Then we also had a break-in at Heathrow just before the Lockerbie bombing, and it looks as if this was basically an investigation team from the United States who've been looking at other criminal behaviour of the CIA, who were heading back to do a prosecution in the United States of those people, and the Lockerbie aircraft was taken out because of that. So two things fitting up Gaddafi. We're now getting to the stage where there's a whole line of things being fabricated effectively to fit up Putin.
What you've got to understand...
But let's just say the Russian armed forces and Russia is not going to be quite an easy as easy a country to take over and to depose the leader as Russia and Putin.
No, they're not.
As Gaddafi.
Well, yes, and what you've got to recognise is that the Western intelligence services are criminals and terrorists. So they have been for donkey's years. In Posimato, the head of the Italian Supreme Court wrote a book, La Repubblica di Stragi Impuni, about NATO intelligence services bombing Bologna railway station, kidnapping the Italian Prime Minister. He headed the Italian police force. Yeah, he's basically the head of the Italian police force. Now, most people in Britain are blissfully unaware of what CIA, MI6, etc. do. The Russians are saying that the SAS are in Idlib at the moment, working with Al-Qaeda to kill children using chemical weapons and blame it on Syria. Now, if you don't believe the SAS do things like that, I can only say to you, you don't live in West Belfast, you don't understand what goes on in the real world. And of course, many people in this country, their knowledge of what goes on in the intelligence services is basically to do with watching James Bond films. That's what they know about it. And in actual fact, NATO intelligence services, according to police investigations in Switzerland, Belgium and Italy, are definitely involved in terrorism 30 years ago. And that's not 3 minutes ago, 30 years ago. And they haven't changed their spots because nobody's ever punished.
OK, let's go to Prime Minister's questions then this week, where there was a question asked about the Skripal poisoning. Another question, it's only the second PMQ since they came back after the summer, but they're straight in asking questions about Salisbury and the Skripals.
John Lamont!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Given what we know about the Russian state's involvement in the Salisbury poisoning, does the Prime Minister think it appropriate that parliamentarians, both current and former, appear in Russian state television?
Minister!
Can I say to my honourable friend that I'm sure we all have doubts about the objectivity of the reporting on Russia today, which does remain a tool of propaganda for the Russian state. Now, decisions about appearing on Russia today is a matter of the judgment for each individual, but they should be clear that they risk being used as propaganda tools by the Russian state. And I know that that is a view that is shared by other members of this House, including the Right Honourable Gentleman, the member for Ross Skye and Lough Arbour, who's made clear he doesn't think people should appear on that station. I would also say the same applies to Press TV, whose licence to broadcast has been revoked in the UK by Ofcom.
I thought it was quite interesting. Her last comment there is she doesn't want people to appear on Press TV, even though no one in Britain can watch it. So she's very much saying things like being Martin Summers. He appears on RT. So do you, Martin, risk being used as a propaganda tool by Putin?
Well, every time we go on air, we risk being used as a propaganda tool by somebody, don't we? And the point is, are we going to have a plurality of voices so that we can actually listen? I mean, for example, the whole question of the shootings in the Maidan Square. Russia Today are the only people who've reported that. It's absolutely crucial information that should be out there, and everybody should realise there's been a court case that pointed the finger at NATO intelligence services for killing all those people. And that should be out there, but it isn't. And the only place you can find that will be RT or coming on or shows like this. And that's the problem. And, of course, they're trying to close down Press TV and Russia Today because they give an alternative view from the one that Bellingcat comes out with, who's basically on the payroll of MI6 as far as anybody can tell.
And also Google are endorsing Bellingcat. They're saying guy is a wonderful, doesn't come out with any
actual fake
news.
What he is somebody, I remember reading about him years ago, he's somebody who lost his job in IT and was bored, and then he went online every day and became an expert on the war in Syria, even though he's never been to Syria and he's not really an expert on weaponry either. But of course he's now an NGO, and as an NGO he can get funding to carry on doing what he does. And I do, when I appear on Russia Today, I sometimes get paid a small honorarium, if you like, for appearing, as you did when you were used to appear on Press TV. And I will go on anybody's TV. I'll go in the Sun newspaper to get my views across. And everybody has got to recognise that in a pluralistic world, there's going to be different views, and you need to listen to everybody's view.
One of the things, actually, I did do a piece, I haven't seen it on Press TV for them recently, and did mention the background to a lot of this is that we've got an extremely weak government here, that the Theresa May, the Prime Minister, wasn't actually elected to be leader of the Conservative Party when Andrea Leadsom fell on her sword in the leadership elections after the referendum, the EU referendum. And also, of course, famously after last year's general election, Theresa May, the Conservatives are having to rely on the DUP, that would be a fine thing, DUP, in order to stay, to keep their majority in the House of Commons. Also, many people have pointed out that Theresa May is a sort of security service appointment. So who is running the country? Is it the Conservative Party or is it the security services?
Well, I think it's a combination of both, isn't it? But I think leaving aside the internal politics in the UK, there is a long-running policy in the Operation Beluga. We know the name of the operation because Paul Borel, who used to head up the French anti-terrorist squad, told us about this, and he said there's an ongoing operation to prevent normal relations between Russia and the West. And therefore, every time that we move towards some kind of normalisation of relations, some incident or other happens to destabilise it. And the reasoning behind that is quite straightforward. The military-industrial complex in the West wants to spend loads of your money on fancy kit.
Okay,
and
final,
they need to justify
our
it.
Final
so that's why they do all of this
about
stuff.
About Skripals was last night on BBC Question Time. This is, again, the Prisons Minister and Bilderberger, Rory Stewart.
I think it is shocking. I mean, the idea that these guys are going in to examine the squint arches in Salisbury Cathedral or the tomb of William Long Espay is a kind of weird fantasy, and it's part of a whole Russian technique. This is maskarovka, which for the Bolsheviks from the very beginning of the 20th century has been about deception. And this is what Putin does again and again. Crimea, he said 5 weeks before he revealed that there were Russian troops there, he denied it absolutely, and he will keep doing this to test us. Which is why Julia's right. We need to respond. And we are responding. So expelling all those diplomats, and those diplomats are not normal diplomats, they're spies, right the way across from the United States across. Putting the troops into the Baltic, these things are vital. If we had not put troops into the Baltic 3 years ago, it's very plausible that we would now be in a situation in which special forces would be popping up in Lithuania or Latvia and testing our resolve. This is his policy. It's an old Bolshevik policy, and you have to respond clearly, firmly, consistently, but above all, and this is where I think the government's got this right, honestly and calmly.
Okay.
Well, there he's comparing the modern democratically elected Russian government to the Bolsheviks, and he uses the word mashkarovska, deception. Now, we've just talked about a court case in Kiev, a court case which has shown that NATO intelligence services killed 80 protesters and several police officers. And we've actually got all the evidence that we need to point the finger. And as I mentioned earlier, Imposimato, the head of the Italian Supreme Court, was convinced that NATO carried out all the terrorism in Italy under Operation Gladio in the 70s and the 80s. I don't suppose Rory Stewart knows what I'm talking about, because he's a very posh boy and he's hung around with other posh boys who were part of the Tory party for years and years and years. And if I mentioned who Imposimato was to him, or even Umas Piatz on the telephone call, he'd go, what? Because he don't know nothing.
What about his links to the attempts to overthrow Assad? Because he is a Bilderberg conference person, and there does seem to be quite a clear link between people like Rory Stewart and effectively a kind of almost international criminal network. He's the sort of person who is put forward to almost defend the indefensible, for example the utter disaster in Birmingham prisons, and he has an incredible sort of ability to defend the indefensible, that is to say things like privatisations of our prisons, when we know that actually what's going on here is that the private shareholders have got absolutely no interest whatsoever in the welfare of people who are put in jail, and it can even lead to lobbying for more people to be jailed so that more people are sent to prison, even though they don't necessarily have to be.
Rory Stewart quite clearly has very close contacts with the British intelligence services. He wouldn't deny it. Even before he was an MP, he used to go to Afghanistan. And, you know, he's definitely very, very close to those people. And he's definitely a spokesperson for them. But when I point, but I don't suppose he's going to face up to the fact that the Western intelligence services, which he presumably thinks are the good guys, are involved in all sorts of skullduggery, as they have been. I'm not saying that the Russian intelligence services don't engage in skullduggery. That's another question. But the Western intelligence services definitely do.
Well, this
as
is
I mentioned MH17 earlier, yeah. The eyewitnesses on the ground interviewed by BBC Russia said they saw a plane from Kiev shoot it down.
And the pilot who's supposed to have piloted that Su-25 committed suicide, apparently, earlier this year. Now,
the problem you've got in the West is that people don't believe that their intelligence services would be evil enough to kill peaceful demonstrators in Kiev in order to try and make the Russians look bad. But I'm afraid they are. They just are.
What we're talking about here is an international organised crime network, which the British intelligence services are very much a part. And one of the reasons I'm off to Holland next week, to the little town of Oosterbeek, next to Arnhem, is to do a talk down there about the Bilderberg Conference and the links to the 10 years before the Operation Market Garden, the Battle of Arnhem, where the British failed to end the war by Christmas. And there were all sorts of fascinating reasons why that battle failed, which I'll be talking about next week. But as part of all this, I think it's a good idea to have a chat to a former Swiss-German banker, Manfred Petrisch, who I interviewed recently. And he explained, I think, a lot about what's wrong with the financial system and the financial criminals in the Western world.
What can you tell us about what's going to happen with the financial system? Because it does look certainly a bit shaky since 2008.
Well, shaky? That's understatement. The whole thing is such a huge bubble that can burst at any second. I mean, you see what happened. I predicted 2007. I predicted the 2008 because of the information I had at the time, and also because I could count one and one is two. I mean, I could connect the dots, and I saw that this was not sustainable. And then it actually happened with the Lehman Brothers crash and all the other things. And we have not learned a lesson from that. You see, what happened was is that the banks were all bailed out, and they pumped trillions of dollars into this whole system. We have this crazy situation that Mario Draghi, as head of the ECB, is pumping 80 billion euros into the market every month, and we have zero interest rates and even negative interest rates, like in Switzerland and in other countries, we have negative interest rates, and still the whole thing does not work.
Okay, so where are we heading then?
To a complete collapse. In a complete collapse of the financial system.
Would it be slow or sudden?
Well, it is happening already in slow motion right now. You know, it's not going to happen like a big crash and tomorrow you wake up and it's gone. It happens in slow motion. And I'm wondering anyway how they have been able to keep this system running for such a long time, because I thought it would have collapsed a long time ago. But since they're doing all these drastic steps, 80 billion euros every month into the system and negative rates. You see, they cannot keep up these negative rates and zero rates, because that means that all the pension funds, all those insurance, you know, life insurance companies, all those people who need interest because they promised this to their customers, like pension funds, life insurance, etc., they're going to go bust because they are not generating any interest with zero interest rates. So, well, how are they going to keep their promises? They can't. That means all the money in the pension funds and for retirement and all that is all going to disappear.
So is there any precedent for this in the past that we can learn from?
Not really, because, you see, in the past, when I say past, I mean like in the 1920s when the big Wall Street crash was and the big depression. You see, at that time, the difference is that we have these huge financial instruments, these huge, which were created, these artificial, which we call derivatives, you know, this huge derivative bubble, which has nothing to do with the real world. You see, what is happening in the financial area is that it's like a big casino where you're placing bets on everything. And I always have said, I don't understand why the financial system and the banks are not under the casino laws. Because where is the difference between betting on a horse and betting on an interest rate? There is no difference. You're betting. And that's what's happening all the time. They're betting on countries going bust, betting on companies going bust. They're betting on everything, on interest rates going up and down or whatever.
Is there anything positive coming out of all this? Do you think there's any kind of light at the end of the tunnel?
Well, what we see now with the Brexit, I think, is that people are realizing, because of also all the information which is on the internet, and if they read the newspapers or watch the BBC or watch any other television news service, is people have woken up. They have woken up that this whole system is just a big lie, and that they are, that the politicians are lying all the time, and the media is lying all the time, and that they are not being told the truth about everything, about why there are wars, why banks are crashing, why they are not earning more, why they are losing their jobs, and all these things.
Well, that's Manfred Petrich from All Smoke and Mirrors blog. And I'll be looking next week at, I think, what I think is some of the origins in the Second World War of this massive international organised crime network that's at work today, most obviously in the West, undermining our political parties and also undermining the media, particularly buying up media that's critical of it and denuding it of decent investigative journalism, etc. So we'll move on now finally to Chris Busby. He's a radiation expert, and I spoke to him earlier today. He was arrested earlier this week. And let him tell his own story about what happened. Basically, the police decided that his laboratory, which he uses for writing scientific papers and court cases, was a bomb factory.
Well, I was in Wales working on my boat. I got a phone call from a police constable woman to say that they'd had a 999 call from somebody, but they wouldn't tell me who, that said that there was a woman at my house acting strangely. And they'd gone to see if everything was all right, she said, and the woman was in a bit of a state because she said that, you know, Chris hadn't come home and she was afraid he was ill or something, you know. So she called me up and said, did I know this woman? This is Ruth. She lives with me. She's a 30-year-old woman from Sweden, very beautiful woman, but a bit loopy. So I talked to Ruth and calmed her down, and then I thought that was the end of it. And then I thought I'd better come back and see if she's all right. So I got in the car, started driving back to Biddeford. I'm a long way, 5 hours. And I got a call from my daughter, Celia, who lives up the road in Torrington, to say that there were all sorts of police cars outside and big cordons and ambulances and goodness knows what. And she went down there to see what was happening, and they said that they'd ordered in the bomb squad and they'd taped the whole thing off and nobody was allowed in or out, and Ruth had to go away with Celia. So I came back to Celia's place because she told me Ruth was with her, and I went in there and talked to Ruth, and, you know, we sat down and two policemen came to the door, knocked on the door, came in and arrested me, put me in handcuffs and took me to Barnstaple police station, threw me in a cell. They said that they were arresting me under the Section 2 of 1883 Explosives Act. So Section 2 says that you are in possession of materials capable of making a bomb, right? And then I talked to the duty solicitor when they got around to interviewing me. So, I mean, I was in a cell all night, in and out, being interviewed and, you know, interrogated. And he said that under this act, if you're found with materials that are capable of making bombs, so if you have substance A and substance B, and there is a way in which you can use substance A and substance B to make a bomb, then they're allowed to assume that you might be going to make a bomb and arrest you and charge you for having materials capable of making a bomb. The onus is on you to say that the reason you had those materials was something completely different and innocent, you see. Now, I've got lots and lots of chemicals here, mostly associated with my work on radiation, that were also associated on my research on the living systems. So I do a lot of research. I've done it all my life. I've always had a laboratory. The laboratory in South Wales for some time, in fact. But then I decided it was too far to go to do that work. So I brought that stuff back here and I put it in a room at the back of my house here. It's a big house. So that's the room that has these chemicals in there, you see. Well, the door was open, so they didn't break in. They just walked in. I talked to Ruthie about it, and she said she wasn't acting strangely. And the first thing she knew about it was the policeman came to the door, opened it, and walked in. And she doesn't know enough about the law to be able to say, hey, you can't walk in, who are you, and all that stuff.
Okay, so what's your take, Chris, on what this is really about, then?
I'm engaged in two big court cases now relating to nuclear test veterans and a British submariner who died of leukemia, and I'm winning those cases. We tried to obtain information under the Freedom of Information Act in Scotland, and the judge said that he thought that we should have that information, and he backed up our request, and the MOD refused the request on the basis that that the information we were asking, which was details of tests that they made on British submariners to see what radioactivity they had in their bodies, we wanted the details of that. They refused to give them on the grounds that it was a matter of state security, and it would affect the security of the United Kingdom to know what radionuclides there were in British submarine crew. So that's the first thing. The second thing is I'm doing another court case for a woman called Doris Butler, a test veteran, whose husband died of pancreatic cancer. And I brought in two quite eminent experts, because they won't let me be an expert, so I'm being the representative. And the Secretary of State of Defense hasn't been able to bring in any experts that will oppose what my experts are saying, because nobody is now prepared to go into the witness box and be cross-examined by me, because I shall reduce them to ashes. So I'm in the process of destroying the Ministry of Defense position on radiation and health. That's the first thing. And the second thing is I've got four court cases now in America where I'm doing much the same thing. One with Stuart Smith and those people in St. Louis, Missouri, where there's a big radioactive landfill, and in Paducah, Kentucky, where there's a uranium plant. And the other one is, of course, the Ronald Reagan case, the sailors case, where they all went over to help the people at Fukushima, and then now they're all dying of cancer. So my star is quite high in the heavens in terms of my scientific expertise and expertise and ability to take these down.
Can I just ask you, why are you not allowed to be an expert witness? You clearly are expert in your topic.
No. The Ministry of Defence took a court case against me in the High Court, in the upper tier, at the Royal Courts of Justice, said this guy can't be an expert because he's biased, because he believes a certain thing about radiation that makes him biased. He's not independent. And the judge agreed. And so the judge found that I wasn't allowed to be an expert, notwithstanding the fact that I've got more scientific research papers out than more or less anybody in this area. I believe that internal radioactivity, like uranium particles mainly, but strontium-90 and all that stuff, that gets pumped out of nuclear sites and is part of the fallout from Chernobyl and nuclear weapons and all the rest of it, that stuff is about 1,000 to 10,000 times more dangerous than the current risk model says. And I've written lots and lots of papers about this, and people are increasingly believing that, and people are coming to me for advice, and my outfit, which is European Radiation Risk, is increasingly being consulted rather than the current radiation risk model. I gave evidence to the Swedish Environmental Court last year, and they accepted the evidence, and they told the government they couldn't go ahead with their nuclear waste repository. That was in January of this last year, and I took the same evidence to London to talk to the British government minister, Harrington, but he refused to come. And so he wasn't there to have it, although, the committee had already agreed that they would hear my evidence, but they kept him away on some bogus pretext of a vote in the House, which there was no such vote. I looked afterwards. So basically, I'm piling on the pressure to these guys, and they've got to get me. Well, they tried to get me with the Monbiot business in the Guardian. They tried to destroy my credibility over Fukushima, but basically that has gone away now. I had lots of interviews with them and eventually persuaded them that there was no hope in hell that they would be able to stick anything on me on the basis of me having some chemicals, given that my name was Professor Dr. C. Busby written over the door, that they hadn't contacted me, that they'd gone in without a search warrant. And they're going to have to persuade a jury, because there's going to be a Crown Court, that I'm a bomb maker. I mean, I said, forget it. They discharged me. They gave me a note which said, no further action will be taken. Insufficient evidence to provide a realistic prospect of conviction.
Can you just talk about briefly about Fukushima?
Well, the consequences we know will be the same as the consequences after Chernobyl. So there will be an increase in genetic damage in the population affected. That will lead to, I calculated, about 400,000 extra cancers in the next 50 years in the population within 200 kilometres, and a lot of dead babies. And a lot of leukemia, but we're not allowed to know any of this because the Japanese have put a complete embargo on any health data coming out of any of the systems in Japan. So nobody can find out what's going on.
What about contamination of the sea?
I think that it's not going to be as dangerous as people are saying. I mean, it will certainly affect the eastern seaboard of Japan very, very adversely, very seriously. But the Pacific is a very large mass of water, and by the time it gets diluted into the Pacific, I don't believe it will have a measurable effect. There'll be some effect, but it won't be catastrophic or apocalyptic or anything like that.
What's your take also on the Skripal case?
It was a false flag operation originally. It was all set up. I don't believe those two guys did it. I don't believe that it was done in the way they say it was done. There are all sorts of problems with it. For example, those guys got to Salisbury after the Skripals had left the house by 1 hour. Okay? So if you just have a look at the timing. So if they then went with their sort of supposed perfume bottle and sprayed the stuff on the handle, the Skripals had been away from there by 1 hour by then, and then they got ill, you know, after they'd been away. So there was no way that stuff that they supposedly sprayed on, well, they couldn't have sprayed it on the handles before the Skripals left the house because they weren't there.
So what would be the point in manufacturing a story like that?
Because the British are currently the American wing of NATO. The Europeans have more or less got fed up with spending huge amounts of money, so they made up NATO North and NATO South, and the British are basically NATO North. So they have to ratchet up all this argument about how the Russians are going to come over the border and eat babies and all that kind of stuff.
That's Chris Busby there speaking to me earlier today about all sorts of stuff, including his own experience with the police. Incredible. It's the sort of thing you expect might happen in China. An expert witness against the government. Anyway, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 8. You'll find this show's podcast story links and comment page this week, oneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Do please join Mohammed for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week, as I'll be reporting from Arnhem. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
Online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.